I want to bless you with something a little bit different. Over these past 2 weeks, we've experienced the onslaught of rare winter blizzards and snow buildup, which caused more than a few mishaps in the lives of those of us who commute. Some of us had to shovel snow for the first time, while some of us were caught unprepared for our slick roads because we still had our summer tires on, sometimes sliding backwards trying to climb those icy roads, while some were bombarded with ice clumps the size of basketballs while traversing the Portman Bridge. Well, we've just come through the harrowing end of the Mayan calendar. Some of us were expecting calamity, only to be told that this is the dawn of a new age. And some of us are still living in the shadow of a shooting that happened just last weekend out in Connecticut. And the last three victims have just been laid to rest. Meanwhile, our worlds are overarched, perhaps even crowded by the season's jovial mood and persistent advertising. Christmas is coming. Christmas is coming. This is good news. But yours truly has also struggled with the flu over the past 2 weeks, and some of you have as well. And yet, we've been enjoying the anticipation that Advent brings, waiting and preparing for the coming of our Lord. How do we make sense of it all? Given today's passage, which declares Jesus Christ as the mediator of the new covenant, our hope, we can find ourselves blessed with hope arriving at a time when darkness seems to be unrelenting. Yet that darkness has not overcome it. The main point to which today's passage directs us to is the very heart of the letter in Hebrews. It's that God has all along had a master plan for how the world would be made right. He has planned from the beginning the way in which the wickedness and frailty of his human creatures would be dealt with so that the entire world would be put back into proper order. This is the message of Hebrews. And as we continue to deal with this juxtaposition of darkness and light, the violence of our world, and the persistent advance of Advent, I bring you a story that tells of today's scripture truth, but in slant, sideways. This story comes by way of a friend and fellow pastor, Danny Unrau. He recounts this story in one of his books, and it's a story about an old family friend who was a photographer. Many of the photographer's ethnic brothers and sisters and forebears had shaken the dust of Russia off their feet in the 1920s, leaving for their relative freedoms and excesses of lands to the west. Somehow, he had stayed behind. The photographer lived in Russia through the difficult interwar years under the horrific leadership of Joseph Stalin, married and had a child as the war raged. And when the war ended and German nationals could leave Russia more easily than before, the photographer made plans with his little family to get out. Finally, they were at the train station, their belongings packed in rough suitcases and boxes or tied up in sheets and bundles. The teeming train platform, crushed with far more humanity than the platform had room for, was a frightening maelstrom for the young photographer artist and his wife, now pregnant. His young son, nearly trampled, was crying, feeling terror. The mass of people pushing, shoving, and shouting, and the easily perceived anxiety of his parents horrified him. Somehow this little family band, holding hands in and around all the belongings they were desperately trying not to get separated from, got disconnected in the crazy crowd of travelers, thieves, soldiers, and sellers. The photographer was suddenly without his family. Frantically, he shouted, "Maria! Maria! David!" No one would ever hear above this noise. retracing steps against the mass of sweating, shoving bodies, trying to get on the train, the photographer could find no trace of his wife and child. Then the train started to move. The human mass convulsed toward the train. People screamed, policemen blew whistles, conductors swore. The photographer elbowed and bullied his way up the nearest steps onto the now moving train, half swimming and mauling his way through the other bodies, thinking, hoping, praying that his wife had fought her way onto the train with their little boy. Well, as the train picked up speed, leaving behind those who could not squeeze on, the photographer started his search along the overcrowded, already stuffy, and soon unhygienic length of the train. He felt a little anxious, but he was relieved to be traveling, and his imagination did not conjure up the image of his little family back on the platform. A homeless pregnant woman with a tearful boy waiting for a husband and a dad who must have gotten on the train without them. The platform was almost empty of people now, and he was not there. As the abandoned family waited on the platform, the photographer kept working his way along the train, thinking he would soon find them. And by the time he had reached the end of the train, the first time, it was raining back at the decrepit Russian railway station where his family waited. A passerby would have seen a pregnant woman sobbing and holding on to a little boy, crying as if she had no idea which way to go or how to get there. Working his way back and forth along the whole length of the lurching train, over and over, the photographer began to realize his family might not be on it. Slowly, the awareness that he was miles and miles away from them at the station made itself known in his consciousness. And by this time, too, the train was close to the border and close to getting out of the country. There was no way back. Like his son in the rain so many miles away, the photographer started to cry, leaning his head against a lurching and steamed up window of the train, and he could not go back. There was no way back. The photographer followed the immigrant refugee route that he and his wife had so much talked about, across the tense and dangerous border, through seamless gray days and dark nights, feeling lonely and guilty and angry. Angry with himself, angry with the communists. The formerly laughing jokester now spoke only when he had to. He almost never smiled anymore. He carried himself like a man depressed. He couldn't quite remember later how he got on the ship and made passage to Canada. He remembered just a gray numbness and blurred shadows of people, officials, and other refugees. But weeks, or was it months later, he unpacked the few things he had clutched in a cloth bag through the journey to his new country, and he began scheming between finding shelter and food and work to find a way to reach his family. He began scheming. In the same week that he unpacked his few possessions, among them an increasingly precious and crinkled picture of his wife, the borders of Russia slammed shut, and his letters to possible addresses were either returned or disappeared without response. Well, the photographer set up a studio and became a Canadian photographer. While photographing families with small children, some of the twinkle in his eyes came back. And as his heartache and loneliness became normal, some of his old, charming spirit slowly returned. Meanwhile, he kept mailing letters to every Russian village imaginable where he thought his wife might be. The response was always an empty mailbox. No letters, no word. Every day he looked at the picture of his wife and wondered and worried about their birth, the boy. Were they alive? Were they well? Were they... Well, he wouldn't allow himself to imagine the worst. A year passed. The photographer took out some pencils and, looking at his wife's fading photo, sketched her as he imagined she might look now. Another year, another sketch. Every year he sketched another portrait of her, making her a year older, imagining her face, the lines of her lips, the arch of her cheekbones, and the soft bristle of her eyebrows, the curl of her hair escaping from under a kerchief one year, or tightly pulled back from her face another. And he put the growing progression on the wall of his photo studio. Those who saw the drawings could see that the photographer was aging his wife along with himself. Finally, the 50s came, and in 1953, Joseph Stalin, the ruthless Peter the Great of modern Russia, died. Nikita Khrushchev became premier of the Soviet Union, and the world held its breath to see whether this short, rotund, sometimes jovial man would be at the very least a little more humane than his Soviet predecessor. One day in 1959, in a little photo studio in southern Manitoba, the photographer read in the Winnipeg Free Press, the local paper, that the normally reclusive, yet cold, warring, and aggressive Russians were sending their leader, Nikita Khrushchev, to New York to address the United Nations. The day he read the news, the photographer hurried out, bought a bus ticket, and left for New York. And with the motivation of years of pain and separation, he found out what hotel Khrushchev was staying at, and he set up a vigil against a restraining rope meant to hold back the crowds, the crazies, the gawkers, from coming too close to the entrance. The second morning of his vigil, as the photographer stood watching and waiting, a line of limousines rolled up to the magnificent building. Something important was about to happen. The hotel lobby, which the photographer could see through the huge brass and glass doors, was filling with serious-looking men in dark coats and hats. Someone of importance was about to appear. Would he actually get to see the man he had come to see? Suddenly, Premier Khrushchev was in the lobby. He was rounder and surprisingly shorter than the photographer had expected. You know, famous people are almost always smaller than we imagine them to be. The Soviet leader headed for the spinning doors, and security men, a head taller, jostled around him, watching the crowds. The entourage moved briskly through the doorway past the uniformed doormen heading to the waiting cars. "That's some country you run, Secretary Khrushchev," shouted the photographer in Russian. "I write letters to your country and I get no responses. Don't you have any systems that work in the mother Russia of ours?" He stressed the ours, pushing for identification. The Soviet leader stopped and looked around to see who was shouting in the Russian, a button pushed by the criticism of his responsibility. He scanned the not-so-small group of faces at the rope. The crowd hushed. Khrushchev moved towards the rope. Now he could see who was shouting at him. The photographer held his ground. The bodyguards became agitated and apprehensive with Khrushchev's move towards the crowd. And Khrushchev himself was stung a little, and not used to open criticism, was shrewd enough, however, to know how to turn an electric moment into a public relations victory. "Where are you from, comrade?" he asked quietly. "What seems to be the problem? You write letters to whom?" The photographer spilled out his story of his separation at the train station so many years ago, and his hopeful belief that his wife and children were still alive somewhere in the Soviet Union. He wrote her name down on a piece of paper and not so gently again scolded the premier for being so paranoid that mail went undelivered for keeping families apart and for the systems failing to have any sense of human decency. The Russian leader seemed genuinely interested and seemed not to notice the criticism. Amazingly, he promised to look into the matter as soon as he got home. Khrushchev handed the photographer's slip of paper with its precious name to one of his aides, and the photographer stood breathless as Khrushchev swung away from him and headed briskly to his waiting car. Thunderstruck by the encounter and overwhelmed by the emotion of just having told his painful story to the most powerful man of the Soviet Union, the photographer felt his knees weaken. Somewhat dazed, he retraced his steps to the station from which he could begin his trip back to his home, virtually unaware of where he was going, thinking only of what had happened and fantasizing about what might come of it. The photographer laughed, and he cried. Emotions of all kinds rose and fell in his spirit and showed on his face. Back in his studio a few days later, the photographer started working on the next drawing of his wife. The pictures made a striking 8-inch by 10-inch border along the top of the wall of the studio now. Soon, 3 weeks had passed, and the photographer wondered about all that had transpired. He relived the brief conversation with Khrushchev over and over. He didn't know how many times he had told the story of his Khrushchev meeting to those interested and those willing to listen, but already he was wondering what he should have said differently. Then one Tuesday, following his daily schedule, the photographer slipped on his coat and walked to get the mail from the post office. Chatting good-naturedly, as always, with the cronies and regulars who visited in the post office vestibule with bundles of mail in their hands, the photographer noticed an envelope in his bundle of bills, and he noticed that it was made of darker, cheaper paper. He quickly turned it over, and in an instant he saw the Russian markings, and his heart skipped to see his name in a tight and pointed indelible pencil scrawl that seemed vaguely familiar. He ripped open the envelope. "My dear Henry, I have found you." The photographer fell to his knees in the post office in a scream shout that commingled all the emotions known to humankind. A mourning for all those lost years and an outpouring of the joy of family found, of hoped for reconciliation. He got up and he rushed home to his studio. Preparations would need to be made. He knew it would be some months before the red tape could be cleared and the arrangements made for his wife and their two children, now mostly grown up, to come to Canada. Months dragged into years. But finally, the Russian threesome passed through customs and into the arms of the photographer, a husband and a father, a man who, through long-suffering loneliness, never gave up. It was a greeting almost too sacred to watch as these four people, shyly exuberant, laughed and cried their welcome, their greeting to one another, really dancing together, a celebration of family. A wife much remembered, a little boy now, a man who couldn't remember his dad, and a daughter who was born after the terrible day on the train platform so long ago. A few weeks later, a new photograph was mounted on the wall in the photo studio, and the new photo of the smiling photographer's wife, newly come to Canada and reunited with her husband after 2 decades of separation, became the end piece. The exclamation mark at the end of the long row of portrait sketches. The thing was done. The picture completed, the broken circle repaired and closed. Reconciliation. Now, God is often yelled at by those who say they don't believe in him, because if he was up there, how could he stand by and let all the human losses the world is full of play themselves out? There was Connecticut. There is the Sudan. There is the Middle East. There's the downtown East Side. Who are they yelling at? God sent his son to die for us, a death that coagulated every horror known to humans, and God stood and let it happen. God knows what loss is. And when 3 days in eternity later, the stone slid open on a man mysteriously, miraculously raised from death to life again, the epitome of hope, life coming back after death, good news following bad news, delight dancing out of horror, we begin to grasp what God is like over time. God knows loss beyond our nightmares and horrific imaginings. But God is higher than that. He is about hope. He is about reconciliation. The ultimate reconciliation that will bring together all that is best beyond time and space and experience. That's the God to link onto. As one soars or runs or walks or crawls or is carried through life, the best is yet to come. And this is what we celebrate and declare when we participate in the Lord's Supper today. And so now I ask those who are serving to please come forward. Now, the Lord's Supper is not a magical spell meant to access a superpower. It is not an attempt to manipulate the powers of God. The Lord's Supper is a way of articulating our faith, of putting what we believe into action. And as we do that together, we see God at work uniting us as a body. This is reconciliation. Not only with him, but with one another, his body. The Lord's Supper is a declaration of dependence on God. It is a proclamation of allegiance to the Creator of us and allegiance to the Redeemer of our souls. The Lord's Supper declares that we believe Jesus died for our sins. He died for us. And he has risen from death and is coming again. What better message for this season than Emmanuel, God with us? What better message than that is that God is coming again? Thanks be to God.